Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Thinkers, The Rise of Partisan Think Tanks and the Polarization of American Politics, by E.J. Fagan, narrated by Chris Sorensen. Publisher's Note: This audiobook contains references to visuals present in the print and ebook editions of the book. Chapter 1. Introduction. How the Affordable Care Act was created. In early 2010, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, ACA, Barack Obama's signature law, was in trouble. Ever since the New Deal, Democrats had campaigned on providing universal health care coverage to Americans. Harry Truman called for universal health care as part of his Fair Deal. Lyndon Johnson created the Medicaid and Medicare programs in the 1960s, but fell well short of covering every American. Bill Clinton's administration came the closest, proposing an ambitious single-payer structure like that of many other developed nations, but the effort ended in an embarrassing political and legislative disaster. The American healthcare system was a messy hodgepodge of lightly regulated employer-provided health insurance, subsidized through the tax code, and public single-payer programs for seniors, children, veterans, and the poorest families. But America's private employer-based system had been established for decades. All previous attempts to reform the system ran up against opposition from stakeholders and apprehension toward change from normal Americans. When Obama's administration set out to craft major health care reform, many Democrats saw it as a dangerous third rail. Rather than pursue a radical change to the American health care system, the Obama administration sought to create a universal health care framework that preserved much of the existing system, whereby most Americans were covered by private health insurance. The ACA was a vast and complicated law which included tax increases, new exchanges where individuals could purchase health insurance, regulatory changes, and a large expansion of Medicaid, the federal government's program to help states provide health insurance to poor families. These alone would have gone a long way toward expanding insurance coverage, but they were plagued by the core problem that American health care reformers had struggled with for decades: adverse selection. Healthy people don't want to buy health insurance and pay premiums until they get sick and need expensive care. But any insurance company would go bankrupt if too few of their plan holders were healthy. Thus, insurance companies refused to cover the care of medical conditions that the patient knew about before buying insurance from them, known as pre-existing conditions. By the mid-2000s, tens of millions of Americans were unable to buy health insurance. Previous Democratic attempts at comprehensive health care reform addressed the adverse selection problem by just providing everyone with government-sponsored health insurance, paid for with tax dollars, but the Obama plan would need a more creative policy alternative if it wanted to require private companies to sell affordable insurance to people with pre-existing conditions. The solution that they decided on originated in the unlikeliest of places: the Heritage Foundation. Heritage has long been the center of movement conservatism in the United States. Founded in 1973 by two conservative congressional staffers, Heritage quickly became a fixture in Republican Party policymaking. In 1989, Heritage's Director of Domestic Policy Studies, Stuart Butler, could see that Democrats were prepared to enact a socialized single-payer health care system as soon as they regained unified control of the federal government. Butler, a staunch conservative economist who had worked mostly on tax policy during his decade at the think tank, wanted to develop a conservative alternative to a socialized universal health care system. In 1989, in a chapter of a volume he edited, Butler proposed a framework to provide universal care under the existing market-based system. Butler and co-author Edmund Heiselmeyer proposed a system whereby all individuals would be mandated to purchase health insurance, with tax credits for those who could not afford it. By requiring everyone to carry health insurance, Butler solved the adverse selection problem. In a lecture connected to the plan's release, Butler framed the mandate as a conservative alternative to socialized health care costs. A mandate on individuals recognizes this implicit contract. Society does feel a moral obligation to ensure that its citizens do not suffer from the unavailability of health care, but on the other hand, each household has the obligation, to the extent that it is able, to avoid demands on society by protecting itself. Butler's plan became the center of Republican alternative health care proposals in the 1990s. Rhode Island Senator John Chafee introduced the Health Equity and Access Improvement Act, which was built on Butler's framework. The law did not pass, but became the basis of Republican health care policy in the 1990s. Then-Governor of Massachusetts Mitt Romney used the same structure to achieve near-universal health care in his state in the 2000s. While the ACA was more generous than the Republican plans and didn't include many conservative ideas also proposed by Butler in 1989, it owed its bones to ideas that originated at Heritage. There was no other way to get to near-universal coverage while also preserving the unique American market-based health insurance system. Obama was able to pursue the ACA because, for the first time in a generation, Democrats won a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate in the 2008 elections. Their planning for health care reform predated the 2008 elections. Former Democratic Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, who lost his seat in 2004, had spent much of the second term of the Bush administration working as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, CAP, which was founded only a few years earlier. While working for CAP, Daschle published Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis, as a partial blueprint for what would become the Affordable Care Act. Critical was both a political and a policy book, diagnosing the problems of the American healthcare system, explaining why past attempts at universal healthcare failed, and laying out a politically feasible reform plan that Democrats could pass in 2008 that resembled Romney's system in Massachusetts. Obama nominated Daschle to serve as Secretary of Health and Human Services, expecting him to take the lead in crafting the law. While Daschle's nomination ultimately failed, his book and ideas heavily influenced the ACA. After a long and politically damaging year debating how to expand health care access, all 60 Senate Democrats finally voted to pass the ACA on Christmas Eve 2009. No Republicans supported the bill or even signaled that they might be open to a deal. However, the Senate bill was flawed and could not feasibly become law. To secure its passage in a pre-Christmas rush, Democrats had included some embarrassing provisions, such as the Cornhusker kickback, which gave Senator Ben Nelson's state of Nebraska a special deal to avoid paying for the bill's expansion of Medicaid, as well as numerous other messy provisions and errors that the Senate expected to clean up in conference committee after returning from the holiday. House and Senate negotiators began hammering out the final deal. But at the last minute, Democrats lost their 60-seat majority. Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts had died in August. The state's governor appointed a Democratic placeholder with a special election to be held in January. Republican candidate Scott Brown campaigned on a promise to kill Obamacare, but Massachusetts was a safe Democratic state, so few expected a Brown victory. However, Brown pulled off a shocking upset on January 19th, ending the Democratic filibuster-proof majority. The ACA appeared dead. Many top Democrats, such as White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, pushed for Democrats to throw in the towel on comprehensive health care reform and instead pass a more limited bill to expand children's health insurance. Progressives did not want to give up on their chance to expand health care access to millions. With no Republican votes, Democrats would have to use the budget reconciliation procedure to pass any bill, which can allow some bills to proceed through the Senate without being subject to the filibuster. However, there were a few problems. First, the Byrd rule limited reconciliation bills to provisions directly related to revenue and spending. But the bill passed by the Senate contained numerous legal and regulatory changes that the Senate parliamentarian would not allow in a reconciliation bill. Second, Democrats hadn't used the complex procedure to pass a party-line major bill since the 1993 Omnibus Budget Appropriations Act and hadn't planned for the ACA to pass with reconciliation. Many Democrats believed that reconciliation could not be used to amend a health care bill that hadn't been intended to pass under the procedure. But within a week of Brown's victory, two staffers at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, another leading Democratic-aligned think tank, began laying a blueprint for how Democrats could pass a final bill. Senior advisor for federal fiscal policy James Horney, along with Paul Vandewater, wrote a private document that came to be known in D.C. as the Horney Memo. Horney, a political scientist by training, and Vandewater had decades of combined experience at the Congressional Budget Office and as congressional staff. The memo laid out a step-by-step plan for amending the Senate bill using the reconciliation process, which would be one of the most complicated processes to pass a bill in congressional history. House Democrats would first have to pass the Senate bill as written, which President Obama would sign into law. Then they would have to pass a new bill that would amend the newly signed law using reconciliation, taking care not to include any provisions that the parliamentarian would eliminate for violating the Byrd rule. CBPP President Robert Greenstein then passed the memo to senior White House staff, who followed its instructions to the T. President Obama signed both the original law and amendments enacted in March, securing the largest expansion of U.S. health care access since the 1960s. These are just three stories of how partisan think tanks played an important role from the very beginning to the very end of the process that produced the largest change to U.S. healthcare policy in decades. Many others played big and small roles in between by coming up with ideas about how to change U.S. healthcare law, estimating the costs and benefits of the changes, or defending or attacking policy changes in the media. More broadly, they have played similar roles in countless big and small policy debates over the past five decades. Indeed, partisan think tanks are some of the most powerful interest groups operating in Washington today. Organizations like the Heritage Foundation, CAP, and CBPP are important players in many of the policy debates that are fought between members of the Republican and Democratic parties. Yet U.S. partisan think tanks do little work in the electoral sphere, such as organizing campaign volunteers, funneling money to candidates and parties, or releasing campaign advertising. They do not represent constituencies, interests, or individuals. Instead, they exert power and influence only through the production and dissemination of information about public policy. How they can be so influential with so little hard political power is a puzzle, complicated by little political science research into their activities. This book aims to address that puzzle, along with the downstream consequences of their role in the American party system. The role of partisan think tanks in American party politics. In most democracies, political parties control their own think tanks. Political parties and their elected officials need policy advice they can trust to make decisions and turn political and ideological priorities into concrete policy proposals. Within the paradigm most common outside of the United States, political parties control party think tanks either as formal party organizations or as de facto formal party organizations organized through university systems. Party think tanks are deeply integrated into policymaking, helping the party to generate positions, write manifestos, staff the executive branch, and communicate their ideas to the public. The largest, such as the German Christian Democratic Party's Konrad Adenauer Stiftung Foundation, have budgets that far exceed even the largest think tanks in the United States. They are almost entirely publicly financed, with political parties controlling their operations. The system of think tanks that has evolved to fill this role in the United States is very different. The U.S. government provides little public financing for political parties in any form, including to conduct policy analysis. To fill the void, U.S. political parties have turned to privately financed 501c3 nonprofit organizations that they do not control. Under U.S. tax law, 501c3 organizations are technically required to be nonpartisan, but in practice they work exclusively with one political party and are deeply integrated into that party's operations. Hundreds of think tanks operate in Washington. Some are small organizations employing just a few people, such as American Compass, which was set up by former Romney advisor Orrin Cass to develop a policy agenda for the Republican Party post-Trump. Others are sponsored by industry, such as the American Petroleum Institute. Many have clear ideological missions that align with one party or another, such as the Progressive Center for Economic and Policy Research or the single-issue Conservative Tax Foundation. These think tanks are often too small to play a core role in party politics and act more like traditional interest groups. Some large think tanks, like the Brookings Institution, are essentially universities without students, who may in practice employ more scholars who tend to support one party over the other but aren't strategic party actors. Others, like the RAND Corporation, are quasi-government organizations working on contract. However, I demonstrate in Chapter 3 that four think tanks stand out from the pack, becoming de facto party organizations rather than mere interest groups. These are the Republican-aligned partisan think tanks Heritage Foundation and American Enterprise Institute, AEI, and the Democratic-aligned Center for American Progress and Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. The biggest consequence of the emergence of partisan think tanks is that they drove the polarization of American political parties. When political scientists consider the causes of the rapid polarization that began in the late 1970s, we rarely point to information as a mechanism. Partisan think tanks did not polarize American politics by themselves. Polarization is a complex and multifaceted phenomenon with causes as far-ranging as changes in media environments, money in politics, and cultural and geographic shifts. However, I argue that well-organized information that is integrated into the decision-making of political parties and elected officials was necessary to enable the parties to take vastly different policy positions. They can disrupt the problem-solving processes that often bring reluctant policymakers of both parties together. If partisan think tanks didn't exist, American politics would be far less polarized. Even beyond their impact on broader trends in American politics, this book demonstrates their ubiquity in modern American policymaking. In anecdotes derived from interviews and archival documents, I show the role that partisan think tanks played in many of the most important moments in recent American political history. During almost all of the episodes that defined policymaking during the era of polarization, such as the Reagan administration's redefinition of Republican Party orthodoxy to the right, Newt Gingrich's decisive first 2 years as Speaker of the House, and the Democratic Party's decade of progressive policymaking on health care and climate change during the Obama administration, partisan think tanks were at the center of decision-making. Plan for the book. The book contains 9 chapters in addition to this introduction, divided into 2 halves. In the first half of the book, I examine how partisan think tanks use information to influence politics, why the system of partisan think tanks evolved, and how they choose which issues to produce information on. In the second half of the book, I explore their impact on American politics, arguing that they were an important part of the rapid polarization of the party system that began in the 1970s. Chapter 2, The Problem with Problem Solving, explores how an opportunistic information producer can capitalize on the problem-solving instincts of political systems by taking advantage of windows of opportunities to accomplish pre-existing goals. Agenda-setting scholars consistently find that policy-making attention is determined by what problems are most important at any given time. Expert information is crucial to problem-solving, as policymakers need to understand the salient problem and find solutions to address it. Neutral experts will provide policymakers with a range of options to consider that they believe will help to solve the problem on the agenda. However, some non-neutral experts, such as those at partisan think tanks, have their own agenda. They see problem-solving as both an obstacle and an opportunity. If they don't insert themselves between elected officials and neutral experts, problem-solving means that their allies in government aren't attending to their priorities and may even be enacting public policy that they oppose. If they can insert themselves, problem-solving becomes an opportunity to pass something, even if it doesn't do as good a job of addressing the problem as a solution that neutral experts might recommend. Partisan think tanks are especially well-positioned to play this close advisor role, even if it occasionally hurts their party in the next election. Chapter 3, The Development of Partisan Knowledge Regimes, asks why the U.S. system of partisan think tanks developed in the time, place, and manner that it did. The United States built up a technocratic policy advisory system composed of nonpartisan think tanks, the federal bureaucracy, and research universities as its policy agenda broadened, which helped to broaden its agenda further. Conservative intellectuals reacted to the growth of government by forming the modern conservative ideology in the 1950s in explicit opposition to the technocrats who, in their minds, enabled it. However, they watched their allies in government continue to work with nonpartisan experts to further expand the federal government for the next two decades. The turning point for modern conservatism came when two congressional staffers founded the Heritage Foundation in 1973, allowing conservatives to field their own experts to counter the technocrats. They were innovative in changing how think tanks operate, allowing them and numerous imitators to insert themselves into policy debates more easily than traditional think tanks. A conservative ecosystem emerged to rival the nonpartisan knowledge regime centered around think tanks. Conservative politicians like Reagan and Gingrich could finally call upon conservative experts to help them make policy decisions. Heritage became their right hand, helping to craft much of the conservative policy achievements of the 1980s and 1990s. Progressives were slow to form an equal and opposite knowledge regime. They didn't hold the same grievances with technocrats who helped to expand the federal government. Indeed, they saw neutral experts as valuable allies to help design enduring policies. Eventually, after seeing Heritage and others pull the party system to the right for three decades, progressives responded by creating a knowledge regime centered around the Center for American Progress in 2003. CAP was explicitly modeled on Heritage, although in some ways it was even more deeply integrated with the Democratic Party. Today, both political parties have well-developed systems of partisan think tanks. Chapter 4, Privately Controlled Party Organizations, examines the roles that partisan think tanks play inside modern political parties. While many interest groups work closely with political parties, partisan think tanks often form much closer relationships with parties than even their closest interest group allies. Because U.S. political parties are composed of broad coalitions with varied, often conflicting policy goals, party leaders need advice that can balance the priorities of the coalition. Rather than represent one interest, partisan think tanks represent the coalition generally. They are particularly important for maintaining a large workforce of policy-making professionals that the party can access when in government. Newly elected presidents from both parties frequently rely on partisan think tanks during presidential transitions for both staffing and policy planning. However, this status comes at a cost. Partisan think tanks are still interest groups with their own policy goals. Political parties may find it difficult to make policy decisions that help them win elections if those decisions clash with their ideological workforce's policy goals. Chapter 5, How Partisan Think Tanks Set Their Agenda, concludes the first half of the book by examining the issues that partisan think tanks publish reports on. The origin story of Heritage is very much one about agenda setting. Its founders were upset that AEI failed to strategically release information criticizing policy that conservatives disagreed with while debates were ongoing. Heritage's founders designed the think tank to quickly respond to issues on the policy agenda. Using a data set of thousands of partisan think tank reports, I examine whether this story fits the agenda-setting patterns of modern think tanks. I find that Heritage does indeed aggressively tailor its agenda to the issues being considered by Congress, but AEI, CAP, and CBPP do not. Rather, these think tanks create a steady stream of reports on their party's core priorities, hoping to lay the groundwork for policy entrepreneurship when the agenda shifts toward their priorities. The book then shifts to examine the impact of partisan think tanks on the polarization of American politics. Chapter 6, The Growth of Polarization and Partisan Think Tanks, examines the high-level and very close relationship between polarization in Congress and partisan think tank activities. Polarization rises in near lockstep with partisan think tank activities. Other forms of neutral expertise decline while partisan think tank influence explodes. The data suggest a clear relationship between partisan think tanks and polarization, but I conclude that the relationship is likely more complicated than the correlation result suggests. The book turns to a deeper examination of the relationship between partisan think tanks and polarization in Chapter 7, Partisan Think Tanks and Polarization Across Issues. This chapter introduces new data on polarization broken down by 20 issues using data from the U.S. Policy Agendas Project and compares it to a variety of partisan think tank activities. Policymaking in many issue areas confronts a starkly polarized information environment, while others see very little activity from partisan think tanks. The chapter finds that the issues that partisan think tanks work the most on are about twice as polarized as the issues that they do not prioritize. Chapter 8, Polarized Policy Analysis, examines the findings in partisan think tank reports. It compares the conclusions of reports from partisan think tanks and neutral experts, such as the Congressional Budget Office or academic centers. The chapter examines three cases: the debate over the cost of the ACA, the debate over the impact of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act on economic growth, and the debate over the revenue generated by the Biden-Harris campaign tax plan. It finds that partisan think tanks often produce results far more favorable to their party's plans than do neutral experts, except for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Finally, the book examines a case study of polarization and partisan think tank activity in Chapter 9, Green Jobs and Climate Change Denial. The positions of the Republican and Democratic parties on climate change diverged drastically in the late 2000s. The Republican Party, which had been the leader between the two on environmental policy to address air pollution over the previous three decades, suddenly reversed course, denying the science on climate change and refusing to support any solutions to address it. At the same time, Democrats began to propose big, comprehensive plans to reduce U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and build out renewable energy, following a broader global prioritization of the climate change issue. The chapter explores the role of partisan think tanks in both changes, finding strong evidence that partisan think tanks were key to polarizing the parties on climate change. The book concludes with a discussion of the implications of its findings in Chapter 10, Democracy and the Information Wars. Democracy struggles to function without some consensus on what information is valid. Without neutral experts, the Republican and Democratic parties will struggle to find compromise.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?